thank you, Greg. I'm now going to go ahead and start the question and answer session with the questions posted online. And then once we get through those questions, if time allows, I'll open up the phone lines for questions. I think I'll just start with questions for Greg, since we just finished Greg's presentation, and I'll just start with the go from the bottom up. Greg, you mentioned fuel subsidies, maybe for biofuels. Can you explain?
Well, to encourage, the use of alternate fuels, there's, the government has put in, incentives as much as I know one that is, I think on the bio side was a dollar per gallon. So, and I would take that as an incentive to, you're basically, the taxpayers are, paying for the, that subsidy to have users use alternate fuels.
Okay. And on the tolling revenue numbers, where did you obtain the numbers?
Those were collected from the American Trucking and Social Research Institute, and those there was another slide that we took out because it was it kind of confused the matter. But if you did look at it, it showed the overall cost, which was pretty deplorable. But we showed this one is because it directly related to the cost, the revenue versus the cost of collecting it. Mm-hmm. I'd have to get that from your answer. That's not a good answer, but the answer to your question, I would talk to Jeff Short at the American Transportation Research Institute or Rebecca Brewster in Atlanta.
Jeff, you're on the line. Is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Am I coming through okay?
Yes.
Those numbers were taken from publicly available financial statements from toll authorities. Basically, what the researchers from ATRI did was have a look at the the operating costs of the toll road, not taking into account maintenance and whatnot, but what it actually costs to collect the toll. And that's what those numbers represent, and they're all detailed in an ATRI report that was released in 2007. Dale's have it. I can send you a copy of that report if you'd like.
Okay, thanks. The next question is, typically toll road operators include planning, design, engineering, etc. in their operations administration expenses. Do your amounts and percentages for motor fuel tax collections include those expenses at state, local DOTs as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I ran it, understand the total question.
Okay, well, if the person who typed that in, if you want to maybe clarify exactly what you mean by your question, that would help. We'll just move on to the next one. With respect to toll charges, can you discuss generally what is the threshold rule of thumb at which point industry will begin diverting to non-toll highways?
I know that in some of the original discussions that the American Trucking Association had with some of the, I know it involved the Chicago portion of tollways and in Indiana, and I believe Ohio, and it was rather interesting because the people in attendance could foresee, because it's a profit situation. These groups of people are buying highways and getting in one case 99-year leases, and it's a profit situation. We could perceive in the Ohio Turnpike Authority example is a perfect one. We could perceive 1 to 300% increases over a 10-year period or more. And the Ohio Turnpike is a very good example, 82% in since between 1999 and 2005. I think that's pretty much an eye-opener.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. Well, we don't have a clarification on that question yet, so I think we'll just move on to some other questions we have here. Well, actually, I'm sorry. Something just came in. So it's a 2% cost for administering state motor fuel taxes. Does that include similar costs that toll road operators include in their administration costs? In other words, are you comparing apples to apples?
Well, if you look at the two side by side, you know, the difference is absolutely and totally, you know, significant. There is no comparison whatsoever. I know that, as an example, in 1980, the state of California, you know, had a deficit crisis in their transportation fund, and they proposed to go to a ton mile tax, and we did the actuaries on that, and at that time, the amount of revenue that would be collected by such a tax, you know, it's very similar to the mileage-based tax, but the revenue would be eaten up by as much, at that time, like 50 to 60% between what it costs industry to adhere to those, to that tax, and what it would cost, you know, the government to adhere to that tax. You know, 60 to 70% of the revenue would be eaten up. The toll, you know, if you look at the toll situation, you can see that, and those costs are astronomical. The cost is, you know, if you raise fuel tax, you know, 10 cents more per gallon, it wouldn't cost you any more to administer the tax. The people and everybody is still in place. It's just a matter of pushing numbers.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to some questions for Tim Adams now. Tim, what is the difference between the Unified Carrier Registration Plan and Agreement and the IRP?
Well, basically, the Unified Carrier Registration, or the UCR as it's called, that was a compromise program that was put into law to replace what was called the old Single State Registration System, or the SSRS. And basically, that process deals with the authority of the carrier to operate and providing a uniform way to ensure the carrier had proper insurance. And basically, there was a compromise between industry and the jurisdictions that were participating in the SSRS to come up with a better program that didn't require a paper credential and that got away from requiring redundant reporting of insurance and that sort of thing. And that was the UCR. Basically, it doesn't have the insurance requirements in it. The carriers, in order to operate, just have to register with their jurisdiction and pay the applicable fee, and the fee is based upon the number of vehicles in the fleet.
Okay, thanks. The next question for you is, from your perspective, to what degree does the IRP control or influence interjurisdictional regulations on trailer weight and or length?
Basically, IRP would not have any input on that. That's in most cases, it'd either be federal-specific regulations or state-specific regulations, laws and regulations that require or that deal with it. IRP really wouldn't have any regulatory authority unless our members ask us to deal with it.
Okay. Is there any way a small percentage of IRP funds could be diverted to public transportation?
Yeah, I saw that question. Of course, that would be based upon federal, state and federal allocation formulas. And I'm sure most, to be honest, I know, of course, I worked in Kentucky for 24 years, and we collected the money from all the motor carrier, the taxes that were talked about, and all those sort of things. So we did, those went directly into the state highway fund.
And what sort of admin or processing overhead is involved in processing the $2
billion? You know, that's a good question. I think in most cases it's probably minimal. I don't know the exact operating budgets of every jurisdiction that we have, and even the operation of the clearinghouse would be minimal in exchanging those fees compared to the actual $2 billion. So I think in most cases you have small offices and operations within the jurisdictions to handle the registration of those vehicles. Small budget to handle.
Okay. And could the IRP be expanded in scope to handle a national permit system?
I'm not sure I understand what that referring to.
Okay, well, if Mr. Schultz, if you want to write in and clarify, or if we have a second on the in a few minutes on the phone line, maybe just provide some clarification there. We'll move on to the next question, which is, why is Alaska not part of the IRP?
Each state does a study to evaluate whether it's worth their while to be a member of IRP. And Alaska did that study on actually two or three different occasions to determine over the years if things changed. And it basically, this was not lucrative for them to be a member. There was not enough interstate operations between Alaska and the U.S. jurisdictions and even the Canadian provinces that they border there to make it worthwhile to be a member.
Okay. And another question, what role does or will technology such as GPS play in determining percentages to members?
They definitely will play a role in helping members keep the records. Technology is playing a key role with the electronic onboard recorders and those sort of thing, making it easier for carriers to maintain the records, maintain their operations, know what the actual mileage figures and those sort of things are. Many things they already use today, but the new technologies will definitely be a benefit to not only the jurisdictions to ensure that they're getting good records, but to the industry to provide those records.
Okay. Did you have? We now have a question that actually is for all the presenters. Do any of the presenters have comments about the German toll collect system that ties tolls to truck emissions as well as distance? I'll open it up to any one of you that wants to jump in on any thoughts on that. Anyone?
Well, not really.
Okay. Well, if we don't have any comments on that, and Jeff, I'll, you know, you're on the line as well. If there's anything you wanted to comment on, feel free to.
Okay, I have no comment on that.
Okay. Well, then we will move on. Let's see here. This one is for Tim. You briefly discussed the potential inclusion of Mexico into the IRP. There have been ongoing concerns about safety and emissions issues from trucks coming from there. Would IRP require evidence that certain standards are met, independently validated, prior to IRP registration?
Good question. And actually, it's one that in most cases, in most states, those things that are required to make sure that a vehicle meets certain safety standards to be on the highways of the U.S. and that the emission standards are met are at the state level and are handled at a different level than the registration process, which is the IRP. So while IRP would be very supportive of it, I don't know that you would ever see anything in the IRP agreement requiring those sort of things. We surely would want to ensure that any vehicles coming in the U.S., our jurisdictions are very alert to the need to ensure that those vehicles do meet the minimum safety requirements at a minimum and probably hopefully above that before they allow those vehicles to be titled and then registered in the U.S. So I don't know that IRP itself would ever have any language specific to it in the plan, I think the individual state requirements will have those and will be increased as we see the if that border finally opens and we see a lot of Mexican trucks operating beyond the commercial zone in the border state, I think you will see a really big push to increase to make sure that those trucks are of U.S. standards and that they meet not only safety but the emission standards.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any other questions typed in. Do any of the presenters have any questions that might have been sent directly to you that I didn't see?
No, I don't think so, Jennifer.
No, I don't.
For me.
Okay. Well, before I open up, we'll open up the phone lines in a minute since we have some time left. There is one question that was sent to me that I didn't address yet about whether past seminars where they're posted online on the Talking Freight archives are eligible for AICP credits. I don't know the answer to that. I think the answer is no, but I will check into that. And when I either send out the follow-up information or I'll send something through the listserv and we'll just clarify that and let everybody know for sure. But I believe the answer is that you do have to attend the live seminar to get the credits. If the operator could give instructions on how to ask questions over the phone, we'll see if anyone has questions there, or feel free to type them in still as well.
Yes, ma'am. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Please make sure your phone is unmuted so you may record your name so I may introduce your name, your question. If you need to withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question over the phone line. One moment while the first couple questions come through. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question. I have a question from Dan Schmidt. Go ahead, your line is open.
Ashley, it's Dan Smith. Question is for Mike Fisher on the off-peak program. I wonder if you picked up any recognition of benefits from shippers and receivers who are at some distance from the port, and even if they don't operate night or early morning distribution centers, that it gives them the opportunity to use the port because they can now ship up to normal working hours and still make a port gate that, say, closes at 7 or 8 rather than one that closes at 4:30.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've looked at this for other applications. We did not hear that from anybody in particular, and I don't know if anybody's looked at, you know, I guess in to some extent what you're saying, Dan, is potentially increasing the size of the hinterland, but we did not pick that up from any of the BCOs that we talked to.
Thanks.
Thank you. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And I have no questions on the phone line.
Okay, thank you. And actually, during that question, I did get clarification from Carol Keenan, who is the Federal Highway Administration contact for Talking Freight. What I said was correct. You do have to attend the live seminar to receive the AICP credits. You can, you know, you're certainly welcome to view the archive seminars, but they're not eligible for credits. And also, I just want to clarify that you do have to be an AICP member to get the credits. I have the instructions on the screen, or you could download them from the file share box on how to obtain credits, but you need to, you basically have to go yourself to the AICP website and log this in there to get your credits. I don't think we have any other questions at this point. I don't see any others typed in, and didn't sound like we have any over the phone. So we'll go ahead and close out for today. I want to thank all three presenters for three great presentations. We really appreciate it. And thank everybody on the line for attending today's seminar. As I mentioned, the recording and the presentations and a transcript will be available online within the next few weeks on the Talking Freight website, and I will send a follow-up email to everybody to let you know when they're available. If you attended today and didn't register in advance, or registered with or attended with a group of people and want to receive the follow-up information, just send me an email, and I'll make sure to include you on that. The next seminar will be held on January 20th and will be about best practices for moving freight through urban areas, and that seminar is currently open for registration, so you can go to the Talking Freight website to register for it. In addition, we'll be soon posting other seminars for the next few months to register as well, and we'll be posting a fact sheet soon with the seminars planned for the next 6 months. I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you haven't already done so. So with that, we'll close out for today. Thank you, everybody, for attending, and have a great holiday and a happy new year.